And I will speak more slowly so that the translators can follow me. And the topic... Well, first of all, I have to make an apology. I thought I would be addressing the experts. Now I'm scared because I'm not addressing the experts. I'm addressing the legal experts who don't need certain lessons on the whole story. But in any event, the causal link, causal nexus, is such an important part of the expertise in every court and in many, many cases, including some of them we shall see in our court, that this is worth pondering about. As part of the introduction, I might say the following, and you can make a little experiment if you want. I don't know whether it works in French, but it certainly does work in English. If you go to Google and you type in causal link, you will get a full philosophical overview of the general philosophical serious problem of causation. Moreover, if you type in causal link law or causation law, you will get a very good, it's true, very good overview of the legal causation, the way it is perceived in the adversary system, in the Anglo-Saxon mode of seeing things. Okay. So here we shall concentrate on the civil law, private law cases, and therefore we shall be concerned generally mostly about torts, damages. In criminal law, I'm a specialist in criminal law more than anything else. We talk a different kind of causation, or I should say different kind of problems, but the same causation. And then let me mention what we have at the bottom here, the class actions and the probabilistic evidence, which does not come into play in any single case, but it comes into play when it comes to employment discrimination, when it comes to ecological problems, when it comes to problems involving Ketliff's law of great numbers. And that's why we talk of probabilistic expertise, and we talk about Bayes' theorem, which translates the abstract probability into something specific and is well known to the actuarians. And we talk about Bernoulli's equation, which multiplies the probabilities, etc. In private law, we know this is sort of axiomatic. The expert is simply a different kind of witness, appointed by the court with the specific empowerment, so to say, that he or she testify not only to the fact that he observes, but also to the link between these facts and the consequences which might occur in a particular case. For example, we shall see the example afterwards. The problem here is underlined in the low red line. The scientists do not speak of causation. Causation in science simply doesn't exist. If you go to the classic book on epistemology by Karl Popper, The Logic of Scientific Discovery, you will see that there may be talk of necessary conditions, there may be talk of different kind of forces that result in a certain consequence, but it certainly doesn't talk about simple causation such as we lawyers are used to. And the question therefore is, why are we so pent up, I should say, why are we so focused on single cause rather than observe the causation as a process, I should say, the interplay of many, many necessary conditions as a process which produces certain consequences. And there is always a great communication gap because of this red line at the bottom. There is always a great communication gap between us lawyers on the one hand and the experts on the other hand. Typically, I know more about criminal procedure. In criminal law, you will ask the psychiatrist, has the mental illness, paranoia, or whatever, been the cause of his insanity, and he will refuse to answer the question. That's not part of his game. It's not in his department, as the French would say. Therefore, there is a communication conflict between the expert and the lawyers, and the question is, perhaps, why? In other words, we are entitled to speak of two kinds of causation, two kinds of causal nexus, two kinds of causal link. In science, the context is never adversary. It was George Herbert Mead who discovered the problem in 1914 and published an article in the American Journal of Sociology in that same year. He talks about friendly versus adversarial attitude. In the friendly context, for example, it's easy to explain, between doctor and patient, the word cause will very rarely come to the surface. Because the issue is not, is my cancer, which has developed in my lung, or my smoking in that effect, the real cause of my illness? We know that it's not. I have smoked since I was 18. Now I smoke cigars, but not in this hotel, it's forbidden. To ask the doctor, is this smoking the cause of my cancer, is an irrelevant question. I come from a medical family, so I know that genetic predisposition, all kinds of things play into this formula. And in the end, if we go to court, like they did in Philip Morrison cases against the tobacco companies, where the lawyers wanted to know what is the cause. Is the cigarette smoking the cause of cancer? That's a silly question. It just simply isn't very, very logical in terms of scientific thinking. But if we go to line one, causation in adversary trial, we were talking about, our friend here was talking about expertise contractuelle, expertise contradictoire. That's a completely different story, and I think it's okay that it be a different story. It is okay, I think, to have the possibility to confront two different experts with two different opinions, but we in Europe, with our adversariness, contradictoire, as they say in French, have not come yet the full play. It is true, this is part of Article 6 of the European Convention of Human Rights. But in other words, what George Herbert Mead discovered is that in an adversary context, contradictoire, things change. They become polarized, and we look for single cause, which in fact, scientifically speaking, may not exist. So this is perhaps a perennial problem in the relationship between judges and experts. The judges will try to force the expert into attributing, and the word attribute here is very important, into attributing consequences to one cause in the sphere of influence of the defendant. The experts will be called, has this particular defendant in a tort case, when it comes to question of damages, been the cause of the consequence for which we now look as far as damages are concerned. It is therefore important to understand that this is not the expert's job. It is the judge who has to take upon himself to maintain, to discover, to attribute the cause to that particular defendant. The expert will normally, if he is enlightened, only say, well, the cause in question the factor in question is not incompatible with the critical consequences at stake in the trial. Here we have a small parcours of the kinds of causations, and let me say at the outset that this one is perhaps the most interesting. We all know what it means. Sine qua non causation is the causation in which the cause, without which the consequence would not have occurred, is considered a relevant cause. Let me revert here very shortly to the framers of the famous model penal code in the United States. I used to teach law in the United States for many years. They have the sine qua non causation built into the
code. That code has now been adopted by practically all American states. And the framers, Wechsler and company, who have constructed the code, say it explicitly. We have put in the sine qua non causation as sufficient for legal sanction because we do not consider the cause, the causation, to be relevant. In other words, when you have a spectrum of many, many different necessary conditions, the law will go along that spectrum and will choose that one condition which will be the blamable, the blamable aspect which may be foreseen, must have been foreseen by the actor and can be attributed to his free will, his dolus eventualis, his negligence, etc., etc. Okay? So that a very important model of legislation has completely circumambulated the question of causation, because they have discovered that it's not something that is very, very reliable. Because what happens when judges and juries specifically look for the cause, intuitively they look for the cause in question, what they simply do is they pick up that one cause, the triggering of the revolver, for example, typically the American example, as that particular decisive factor which on which the blame can be can be attached. And therefore the sine qua non cause is sufficient for responsibility, which simply means that it really doesn't figure as an important factor in the question of attributing the responsibility. In Francis Bacon, this is a very old formula. We know that in jure non remota sed proxima causa spectator, which simply means that among the many necessary conditions, we shall seek the one condition which is proximate, which is relevant from the legal point of view, but which simply means, if we peel that on a little bit more, which simply means that this is the one when we attach the blame. And that is what called the proximate cause, but it's one of many causations. Here we have two very interesting Italian cases, Mastro Matteo di Italy and Calvelli and Cilio di Italy. Let's start with Calvelli because that's a medical case. I didn't attach, you can find it in the internet very easily, I didn't attach the rather data. GC means Grand Chamber, European Court of Human Rights. In Calvelli, we have a doctor who was following a pregnant woman who had a diabetes. I think it was in Naples. She was about to deliver. She was taken to the hospital, and the doctor who had been following her pregnancy in view of her diabetic complication was not there. During the delivery, the child died. In other words, this was an Article 2 question when it came to the European Court of Human Rights. The child died. The question was, is the doctor responsible or not? Clearly, it is not for the European Court to delve into facts of such matter, because we are not a fourth instance court. But we read the expertise, because it's part of the dossier, it's part of the file, and it comes to us. And the question therefore was, has Italy, who has prosecuted this doctor, but has not in time executed the sentence, after 5 years the sentence was delay was too long, whether Italy as a state was responsible for not prosecuting, for not punishing, in fact, the doctor or not. Our answer to that question, and it was a pretty, it's not a very clear judgment, was no. And there was a big debate in the deliberations, but I swore at the outset that I will not be disclosing the what happens in the deliberation, so I can't tell you, but the case is there for you to read, and it might be interesting. Mastro Matteo is more dramatic. Mastro Matteo happened in Milan. I think we have one here, and he might be acquainted with the case. In Mastro Matteo, giudice delle penne in the house of in the prison, released two former co-conspirators at the same time without having verified that they are of the same conspiracy. They gave them a furlough of 3 days, and lo and behold, in those 3 days they robbed the bank. They came together on the outside, they robbed the bank, and the poor Mastro Matteo's son, because that was his father who prosecuted the case in the European court, was sitting in his car in front of the bank. One of these robbers came to him point blank, putting the gun to his head, and said, "Either you give me the car, or I'll shoot you." And of course, the kid didn't give the car, and he was shot on the spot. The question is, a question of causation, is the giudice delle penne responsible for that because she overlooked the fact that they were both from the same conspiracy, which was, of course, in their files? The case came before us, and we squeezed sort of out of the question of causation. But if you look from the sine qua non point of view, the judge was clearly responsible. If she didn't have done that bureaucratic mistake, so to say, Mastro Matteo would have not been killed. It is a question of causation. Next, we go to another Italian case. I'm sorry, we only have Italian cases, I don't know why. Giuliani. In Giuliani, which came out about last year, we dealt with the question of G10 riots in Genoa. On the occasion of G10 meeting, there were riots, emeute, and the whole city was aflame. The gendarmerie and how do you call them in Italian, the carabinieri, were all over the place. The thing was badly organized. The carabinieri were not equipped with guns that would be only have rubber bullets, etc. And on the point of panic, one very, very young carabiniere who was being attacked by a fire extinguisher from the part of one of the demonstrators caught panic, and he shot point blank out from the jeep. Of course, there were many, many different small questions of causation in that particular case. Excuse me. The Italian courts very diligently dealt with that. I had the whole CAT scan of the body available when I dealt with that case, etc., because the question was the direction of the wound that comes from the bullet, etc. But that's not the point. The point before the European Court was, is the European Court willing, because we are an international court, the defendant in our court is always the state, is the European Court willing to see the remote causal link between the mass organizational disorganization of the protection in Genoa at the time, on the one hand, and the specific consequences of the death of young Giuliani on the other side, one of the demonstrators? Admittedly, the link, of course, is very, very remote, and it's completely unacceptable for a specific court in Milan or elsewhere, national court specifically, to deal with that question. But in my opinion, the European Court, and I think I wrote a dissenting opinion in that case to that effect, in my opinion, this is what international courts are all about. Because tomorrow we had cases like this in Greece, I forget the name now, obviously we should have cases like this in Turkey, and maybe we could have had them in London recently, etc. And the question is the state responsible? Although the causation here is very much remote. And which tells you that we are not talking about causation per se. We're talking about causation in a particular context
in which the state is the defendant, in which a different logic of causation may come into play. However, in Giuliani v. Italy, the court did not live up to that challenge, I must say, and it might be interesting for you to double-check that case. I have it in French, of course, as well, because all the Grand Chamber cases are translated. This is Summers v. Tice rule, and it's not interesting for you because it's a typical criminal law rule. Then we're talking about contributory causation, which is also part of the... Am I
okay with time?
I was talking about contributory causation, where you have two contributory causes, which may or may not be, both of them may be necessary conditions, which result in the consequence, which is the subject matter of the trial. In the Anglo-Saxon law, this is pretty clear. The judge will attribute the responsibility, because the remedy is always the other side of the coin of the right. The judge will attribute the damages, the payment of damages, pro rata, so to say, to those who contribute to this causation. In other words, contributory causation is a more sophisticated view, and it's not focused on a single cause. And in criminal law, that's difficult because the question is discrete, is he guilty or not? But in private law, it's more easy because you can apportion the damages according to the percentage, so to say, of causal contribution by one or the other party. In our court, the expertise is very often part of the dossier. Another Italian case, Scozzari and Giunta, which was a revolutionary case in which we introduced the restitutio in integrum according to Article 41 as one of the basic remedies that the court can use, and which has led later to the cases such as Assanice v. Georgia, Broniowski v. Poland, etc. This was a very, very important case for other reasons. But in Scozzari and Giunta, you have mother and her mother, grandmother, who have two boys, or two children, in a Forteto foyer next to Florence, and they want to get them out. In the course of litigation, it was discovered that one of the directors of that foyer, of that Forteto, was a convicted pedophile without a criminal record for the last 20 years, etc., but nevertheless, that was an important point. I remember very specifically in this particular case how misleading, really tragic, were the expertise submitted by the social workers, psychologists in this particular case. So when the court considered the situation, when we looked at the expertise which was part of the dossier, psychological mostly expertise which was part of the dossier, we even saw the videos of interviews with the children, etc., etc., it became very clear that in this particular case, restitutio in integrum, in other words, the return of the children to their mother and grandmother, was very important. But generally, expertise is not, in our court, determinative of the outcome, because we don't deal with facts, supposedly, insofar, of course, as facts can be and are separable from the law. An exception to this is in many Romanian cases, because of a basic case, Grumarescu v. Romania, we rely on the expertise as far as the estimate of the real estate is concerned. This is it. What I would try to pinpoint here is perhaps in this short introduction that causation is really a very, very complex problem, and that we lawyers tend to reduce it to a single focus simply because the contradictoire, the adversary context, tends to reduce the focus to the question as to who is responsible for the consequence, one, and two, perhaps should be one,
for whom the consequence as such was foreseeable, and what kind of attitude, guilt, etc., etc., he had vis-à-vis that consequence. Thank you very much.